What's up, guys? This is the Startup Catalyst podcast brought to you by Sultan Ventures, the show where we interview entrepreneurs and investors on the stories and catalysts of their startup successes and failures. I'm your host, Luke Tucker. Today's episode, we welcome Ross Baird, founder and CEO at Village Capital. One of the most amazing stories, I think, in venture these days is the PhilCap story. So you're going to hear straight from the founder some of the amazing things of how they got started, where their vision was. And there's even stories here that I would think, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that there's no other place that Ross has told some of these stories, including probably the cherry on top of our episode is him telling a story of a dinner party he had in Rome with some famous actors. So stick around for that. You're not going to want to miss that story. A few nuggets and takeaways that I had. You're going to find out what the maximum Fibonacci sequence number is. Bet you can't guess that number right now. The thesis of leveraging the collective knowledge that's kind of central to what PhilCap has built their investment model around in terms of this peer review process. And what are what he calls two pocket thinkers. What does that mean? How is that applied in what he's talking about? And what's up next for PhilCap? So much good stuff, guys. So enjoy on your commute to the office and that quick gym session while you listen. Make sure you remember to take some notes from this awesome conversation and enjoy my chat with PhilCap's Ross Baird. Ross, thank you so much for joining me on the Startup Catalyst podcast. It's an honor to be chatting with you today. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be here, Luke.
Now, Ross, I'd love to kick off with the story about how you got into venture capital.
Yeah, so I've always been an entrepreneur. I've always started stuff. And how I got into investing in startups was every startup founder has that story of that person who took a bet on them when nobody else would. And my greatest mentor is a guy named Bob Petillo, who backed a startup that I started when I was in college. It was an education technology startup. We had a lot of fun. We did some good stuff. Turns out it's a lot harder to build an education technology startup than I think I thought it would be at 18. But we built a civic education platform, got it in classrooms, 500,000 kids used it. It didn't really materialize into anything big, but it was great. Bob and I stayed in touch. He became a mentor of mine. And about 7 years later, Bob wanted to start doing, he had been doing a lot of one-off backing of entrepreneurs like me. He called people like me that he was investing in Inklings. He had a bunch of different Inklings. He said he wanted to formalize a little more. And he had this idea for a firm called First Light that would be the first funder of startups. And he wanted me as an entrepreneur to come work for him. My job description was about that. My literal job title was Hurricane Chaser. I went to Bob and I was like, Bob is a perpetually out of the box guy. I went to Bob and I was like, I don't know that I can go around with a business card that says Hurricane Chaser, like be taken seriously. And Bob says, you have no imagination. What's wrong with you? And they ended up getting the job title investment analyst, which was like more mainstream. But our goal was to find people who needed a Bob, needed someone to take a bet on them. And I can tell you more about what we learned there, but my job description was basically go chase hurricanes.
Yeah. Now, did you guys raise money at that point or was it all still like kind of house money with him?
No, Bob was a really successful entrepreneur. He was a real estate entrepreneur, and it was originally just Bob's money. He wanted to invest in businesses that were doing something meaningful for society.
So fast forwarding to like Village Capital, just in terms of, loving your kind of mission about this democratization of mm-hmm. capital. So both that geographic perspective as well as an inclusion perspective, obviously very ambitious and admirable goal, one that resonates with the Sultan Ventures team as well. But practically then, like, how do you go about this democratization of venture capital?
Yeah, so I work for Bob and I work for First Light, and Bob's goal, he wanted to invest in 987 businesses in 10 years.
987, that's a very arcane number.
Bob believes that the Fibonacci sequence is one of the great patterns of nature. 987 is the largest three-digit number in the Fibonacci sequence. So
that's amazing.
We had, this mandate, go out and find 987 businesses. We are going to be, everyone needs a first believer. We're going to be the first believer in these inklings. And we're a small team, a really great team, really, really smart people. But being in Atlanta, we looked at different companies, and just the time it took to find, deal with, talk to the companies, make investment decisions. 6 months later, we had invested in 3 companies. And like, do the math, 3 in your first 6 months is a lot by venture standards.
Yeah.
Not going to get to 987 in 10 years. And when you look at the numbers in startups, 78% of startup investment goes to 3 states, New York, Massachusetts, California. Less than 5% goes to women. Less than 1% goes to people of color. And when I was a white guy in Atlanta investing money, like, you realize why that happens. You talk to people, you're like, who should I invest in? People tend to invest in people they know through school networks or old jobs or whatever it is, and products they understand. And so the problem we were trying to solve was to find people that didn't have a first light or didn't have a Bob. And we just kept talking to the same people and that were in our networks. We said, okay, so this process that venture capitalists use actually isn't solving the problem which we're trying to solve, which is get people who don't have a shot to start their business start, because we're just talking to the same people we already know. So we looked through other models, and I had worked in India for 1.5 years for a startup microfinance bank, and Bob personally had invested big in the microfinance industry. If you're not familiar with the microfinance industry, they have a model called the village bank, where you're in Bangladesh or India or Nigeria, wherever you are in a microfinance bank, you gather groups of small scale entrepreneurs, mostly women, and you do weekly meetings, and the women themselves forecast whether or not the other women that they know are going to repay a loan. And the women who are getting $150 loans in rural India are the ones who decide where capital goes. And microfinance has reached amazing scale. $20 billion globally has been invested in $150 loans. And so the conversation that led to Village Capital was, me and Bob were saying, okay, this village bank model where entrepreneurs decide where capital will go, it's had astonishing success. And it's gotten money in the hands of people that have never had access to capital before. Could we take that to the venture capital level? It's solving some kind of similar problem. And so Village Bank plus venture capital equals Village Capital. I pitched Bob on running a pilot in New Orleans. We were originally thinking San Francisco. And I was like, well, Bob, we should go to cities that people aren't investing in. And Bob was originally didn't just say no. He said, hell no. And I was like, Bob, we should try. And Bob was like, would you bet your career on us being able to find good entrepreneurs in New Orleans? If we lose money on this, like, I just don't know. It's like, Bob, I bet my career on it. You can fire me if we don't find money, if we don't find good entrepreneurs in New Orleans. And we worked in New Orleans. It was our first pilot, and we invested in a couple of great companies. One of our best companies we ever invested in is a company called Kickboard, which is revolutionizing education technology. We were their first investor, and the second Bob met Jen, the founder of Kickboard, he looks at me and is like, you were right. And so what we do, which is work with and build communities of entrepreneurs and let the entrepreneurs make the investment decisions, has brought an incredible number of new people into the conversation.
That's phenomenal.
Now, when you guys actually looked at energy, agriculture, education, financial services, and health, how did you choose those sectors?
We want to solve problems that matter. And I think when you look at the things that really threaten society, I think there are two problems that are bigger than everything else. One is income inequality, huge gap in opportunity between people who have resources and people who don't. Whether it's the rise of ISIS or Brexit or the rise of Donald Trump, like, things that in the newspaper are genuinely scary to the global markets are the result of a lot of people feeling like they aren't participating in the economy. And so I think that there is obligation for people who care about capital markets to invest in things that provide opportunity to folks. And so if you look at what poor families spend money on, it's healthcare, it's education, it's financial services, and making these things better and fairer and more transparent is really important. The other big threat, and I know you see this in Hawaii, is resource sustainability of the planet. We have a growing population that is consuming a lot of stuff, and the reality is, if we don't change our food systems or the way we use water or the way we power ourselves, we're not going to be able to feed ourselves as a planet. We're not going to be able to generate all the energy to, you know, live the way we want to live if we continue going in the extractive economy that we run today. And so we organize, like, what are the two big global problems that are too big for philanthropy to solve that capitalism needs to be engaged with? The opportunity gap between rich and poor and resource sustainability are the two big themes. And then those, we've picked education, health, financial services within the opportunity gap. Within resource sustainability, we have agriculture, energy, water. And so basically, is this company making a dent in solving a problem that threatens humanity's existence? Seems like a pretty good organizing investment thesis.
Yeah, and a lot of those problems too can be, you know, amplified when you're in an island state, like how much we actually ship here and those different things. Like if the boats stop coming, we don't eat.
No, it's interesting. We ran a very early pilot of the Village Capital process in Hawaii with Kamehameha Schools and the Kale Felicitas Foundation called Hawaii Investment Ready. And we had Native Hawaiians come up with ideas. And the idea of peer review was liberating to these folks, who a lot of these entrepreneurs are incredible. And they were doing things in agriculture, things in sustainability. And a lot of them would try to get bank loans and hadn't because the lenders didn't understand what they were doing. But they all totally understood what each other was doing. But it became like a running joke. Every single pitch, the first slide that each of the entrepreneurs put together was something like, we are so worried that the shipping lanes will be cut off and we will starve 4 days later. And it's like obvious that resource sustainability is top of mind for everybody in Hawaii. And there's very real incentive for business to solve this problem.
Absolutely.
It was awesome.
Now, you were talking about New Orleans and a couple of the first investments. And I was reading a blog post where you kind of went through the feel goods investment story. Can you kind of do a recap of that story?
Yeah. So I think a lot of people ask, okay, so you're investing in businesses that are trying to do good. Can you actually make money in businesses that are trying to do good? And I believe, and there's evidence says that businesses that have a purpose beyond just financial returns outperform. Mm-hmm. And our very first pilot in New Orleans is evidence of this. So remember, my job was on the line. I was going to get fired if this went badly. We had a company called Feel Goods, which is the first fair trade certified rubber company in the U.S. And they, the way that we set up the programs, we've got 10 companies. They're each going to get $100,000. Midway through, they're not there each. Two of them are going to get $100,000, and the entrepreneurs themselves are going to pick. Midway through the program, Feel Goods got a big purchase order from Whole Foods for their flip-flops. So they needed cash like yesterday. So they went to the other entrepreneurs and they're like, could we get a cash advance against the prize at the end? And we entrepreneurs are always breaking the rules. It's great. And Kyle, the founder, says this, and the entrepreneurs voted and they said, yeah, we'd like to give Feel Goods the cash advance. Whole Foods is going to pay him back. We've got something to lend against. It's great. So Jen Kickford, the education technology company I mentioned on the other end, was owed the money. They ended up winning, and they were owed the money that Feel Goods had taken out. And when Feel Goods would repay the cash, Kickboard would get. We thought it was great. Feel Goods will get the money. They'll sell the flip flops. Kickboard will get the money. Everyone has been helped. More entrepreneurs have been helped. Wonderful. The BP oil spill. I don't know if you remember this, but remember the Gulf of Mexico was shut down for months because there was a Deepwater Horizon oil spill. And one of the casualties of this was Feel Goods. Their flip-flops at the time that they had paid for with our money were sitting in the Bahamas trying to get into New Orleans, and they were stuck. The shipping lanes were shut down, and they weren't going to get to New Orleans until September. And Whole Foods was like, people don't buy flip-flops in September. Sorry. So Whole Foods canceled the purchase. Feel Goods was stuck. We owned like 20,000 flip-flops sitting in the port of the Bahamas. What are we going to do with these? And so I had an intern. He like looked into selling them on college campuses or something. But the real problem was Kickboard needed the money too. And now they weren't. So everybody was in bad shape. So I write a blog post and I say, BP is just screwing over the little guy. Here is this flip-flop entrepreneur, and he's screwed up, and this education entrepreneur, she's going to fail, all because BP is terrible. But here's how you can help. You can buy a flip-flop, go to Feel Goods, and like buy one.
I think we have a second career in PR, Ross.
Yeah, so I was hoping we'd sell like 10 flip-flops. Turns out the CEO of Groupon read that blog post that I wrote. It was posted on change.org, the website. The CEO of Groupon was like, this is terrible. We at Groupon, we can help. So he made Feel Goods flip-flops the daily deal in every single Groupon city in the world for 24 hours. And the mission was, here are two great entrepreneurs. There's this fair trade entrepreneur. There's this education entrepreneur. BP is bad. These people are good. Buy a flip-flop and you can, you know, stick it to the man and help these two entrepreneurs. And in the end, the thousands of flip-flops sold out in 4 hours. Feel Goods was saved. They've now got retail outlets across the U.S. Kickboard got their start. It was just, we couldn't have asked for a better result. But the reason why Feel Goods was saved is people resonated with the mission. People obviously did not resonate with the mission of BP and were quite happy to buy flip-flops and give them a middle finger. But they wanted to help this flip-flop company and they wanted to help this education company. And I would argue that because the consumer public resonated with what Feel Goods was doing, that's why the CEO of Groupon read the story and said, hey, let's help these guys out. So when you are doing the right thing as a company, people really want you to be successful.
That's such a powerful thing, right? Like you said, it goes back to, you know, investing in social missions. Does it actually have an economic reason? And that's even just a very human reason that people want to actually buy the products or help out. You know, Russ, you had a great quote in a video on your homepage, actually, and I'm going to read it to you and ask you to kind of unpack it a little bit. So the quote is, the entrepreneur taking the reins of the free market is the most unstoppable, fastest growing force in human history. Can you kind of dive into that? What does that mean to you?
Yeah, so when we think about changing the world, most people in their minds default to charity or philanthropy. And I think most people are what I would call two pocket thinkers. Okay, for most of my life, I'm going to make as much money as I can, put it in one pocket. I'm going to take once I've been successful, I'm going to take this and give it to charity or set up a foundation if I've been really successful or give $25 to my friend's nonprofit if I can. But those are two different pockets. And we at Village Capital and the entrepreneurs we work with are one pocket thinkers. The money that goes to your business, the money that you earn and the things that you care about have to be integrated. And the reason why is a lot of people say, well, business is just for making money and charity is for doing good. The value of all the foundations in the world added up is a little under $1 trillion. The value of all of the public companies in the world added up, this doesn't even include private companies, the value of all the public companies in the world added up is $200 trillion. If all of the capital markets were the size of the Statue of Liberty, the size of the foundations would be the size of like a grasshopper. It's just so skewed. If you have business moving in one direction, the capital markets are so big and move so fast that you can make such fast progress on a problem that the business wants to solve. So business is not separate from the way we want to change the world. Business has to lead the way in the way we want to change the world if we're going to make any difference, because there's just not resources relative to the size of business and philanthropy for philanthropy to do it by itself.
Now, Russ, Sultan Ventures is part of one of your Village Capital communities, obviously. Dark Sultan had a chance to interact with you. I asked him, what should I ask Ross? And he said, ask him about the workshop he did for the Zoolander 2 crew.
All right. So that's even better. So I have a friend who was living in Rome. His name is David Lane. He used to run the One Campaign, one of the world's greatest guys. And David said, I'm living in Rome. If you are ever coming through Rome, stop by the ambassador's residence. Beautiful house. I was in India. We do a lot of work in emerging markets. And I planned a layover in Rome to go see David for the weekend. And David says, well, I do these weekend dinners and, you know, people come through are interesting, like you can talk about what you're doing. And so I came by and I like thought it was gonna be like diplomats and people working for the World Food Program. We're gonna talk about world hunger and stuff. But the week before, David had hosted a dinner and the guest was Oscar-winning Italian film director. And Zoolander 2 was being filmed in Rome at the time. And so Ben Stiller and Kristen Wiig and Billy Zane and Owen Wilson had come. And they loved the party so much. They're like, David, when's our next party? And David's like, well, I have other friends who are going to be here next week. And so David wrote me a note a couple days before. And he's like, you are going to be the least famous person at this dinner that we were putting together. So I show up and I, yes, I'm certainly the least famous person there. And I start talking to people about what we're doing. And Ben Stiller was very, very nice. And he's like, so what are you doing? And I explain, and he's like, and how do you decide which companies to invest in? And I said, well, we, actually, the entrepreneurs themselves decide who's good or who's bad. And Ben Stiller is like, you know, that's brilliant, because there are some people who are terrible actors, but they keep getting great parts because they're awesome at auditions. But like, we all know they're bad actors and they end up being bad in the movies. Like, we should do that for auditions. And he's like, there are other people who are like awesome, but never do well in auditions. Like, he's like, auditioning is not predictive of whether you're going to be good as an actor. And it turns out there's a lot of research that Cirque du Soleil actually picks which performances they use through peer review. So Ben Stiller was like, we should take the Village Capital process and do an audition. So I talked to Billy Zane, and Billy Zane was like, what do you do? And I explained, he's like, he's like, I'd like to give that a name, Impact Economics. And I was like, well, that is like kind of like, there are people who call it like impact, you're kind of on the right track. And Billy Zane is like, now let me, I've got an idea. You've got, he's like, you should think of what you do in terms of a network. And I was like, well, it kind of is a network. He's like, no, like a TV network. Like, you should do shows for your entrepreneurs. Because like, even if the companies don't make money, shows might make money. You've got a lot of great content. I was like, interesting. And he's like, and let me tell you, I've got a great idea for one of your channels for your network. I was like, all right. Yep. He's like, I think you need to add a maritime channel, because imagine there's all this buried treasure around the world and you could film your entrepreneurs. Look, people would love it.
And episode one in Hawaii.
Yeah. So we did, so the maritime thing in Hawaii. So when you watch Zoolander and Owen Wilson says to Ben Stiller, listen to your friend Billy Zane. Billy Zane is like the advisor of Zoolander. We have not yet listened to Billy Zane. We do not run a network. We do not have channels. We're not hunting for buried treasure. But maybe that's on Village Capital's 2017 game plan.
There you go. So speaking of maybe the last question for us here, Village Capital, you guys raised, you know, $17.5 million around there in early this year. So what's next for you guys? What's the big plans coming down?
Yeah, so we and this is why we're excited to work with Sultan Ventures. I mean, the one of, you know, the one of the things I'm most excited about is this VILCAP Communities Initiative. We have historically, for the last 7 years, we've made 70 investments through peer review. I told you the stats earlier about investments. 40% of our investments are women. 20% of our investments are people of color. 90% of our investments are not in the three cities I mentioned. And 90% of our investments are growing every month and thriving. So like the thesis is working. But we, Village Capital, think that for us to say we're going to go take over the world and we're going to set up a Village Capital in every city, that's so not who we are. I think that rather what we want to do is make entrepreneurship accessible to everybody. But we think that you guys in Hawaii are a better place to bring opportunity to Hawaiian entrepreneurs. And, you know, our partners in Cincinnati are better place to bring water solutions to the forefront. So I think that what's next for us is to grow partnerships with awesome folks like Sultan Ventures and bring opportunity to entrepreneurs in new places. We have, you know, we'll probably make 20 to 30 investments over the next year. But if we can prove that, you know, if we can prove that there are great entrepreneurs everywhere, we can turn our $20 million fund into much larger pool of capital that we would work with you guys and a lot of other people like you to invest. So I think, you know, I heard once that as you grow as an organization, the temptation is to do more, but you actually want to do less. Like, we find great entrepreneurs, we run programs that help make them better and get them in front of the folks they need, and we invest in them. And it's doing just that really well will change the world for hopefully a lot more than 987 ventures.
Well, Russ, I applaud you and your whole team there. You guys are doing great things. You know, many people in tech, I think, talk about diversity as a problem, but you're fundamentally, you know, doing something about it. And obviously, it's a great success. So I wish you guys, you know, continued success in that. Absolute pleasure having you on the show today. And good luck with everything going forward.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Such a fun time chatting with Ross. We'll have to get him out to Hawaii very soon. Again, please share this episode, subscribe, rate, review on iTunes. That's amazing. You're amazing. Thank you so much. This is the Startup Catalyst podcast brought to you by Sultan Ventures. I'm your host, Luke Tucker, signing off, and stay tuned for the final episode of season one of the Startup Catalyst podcast coming up next week, as we got something special coming up in store for you. Thanks, guys.